Duncan, tell me a little bit about your work with Epsilon Butis. Fascinating subject.
Well, it began back in the 1960s when I was when I first became president of Astra. I set up a discussion project on interstellar travel with the aim of writing what became Man and the Stars. And it was a writer on interstellar travel in CETI by the name of John McVeigh who put me on to this particular inquiry. Essentially, it went back to the 1920s when a mysterious phenomenon had been discovered called long-delayed radio echoes. And a professor, Ron Bracewell, at Stanford University, had suggested late in the 1950s that this might have been an attempt by a space probe from another civilization to contact us. Now, when I started work on the book, I went to the original references, and I saw that what had been happening with this phenomenon was that radio echoes were being received, but the time delay on which they were received was varying. It was discovered when they were studying around-the-world radio propagation, and it was discovered that these echoes were occurring initially with a delay of 3 seconds, which was roughly the distance from the Earth to the Moon, equivalent to that. And then later, the time delays began to vary. And I'd written this up as apparently just a natural phenomenon. But something made me go back to Bracewell's papers, and there was a very interesting comment he'd made that if we did establish contact with such a space probe, the first message from it might be an image of a television image. He was thinking of it might be an image of a constellation. So I was looking, it kind of went on working in my mind, and suddenly it occurred to me that the stars are spaced at random in the sky, so a series of star map coordinates would be a random series of numbers. So I started, I constructed a graph, and I graphed the sequence of the echoes against the delay and didn't see anything recognizable. And I tried reversing the axes on the off chance that something might pop up, and to my great surprise, found myself looking at what seemed to be an image of the constellation Bootes, with that particular star, Epsilon Bootes, picked out. It was a quite staggering moment. I was on a train at the time, and my reaction was such that everyone round about was looking at me, and I thought, shall I tell them? No, they'll pull the communication cord. But it was an extraordinary moment. It really looked as if I might have got the first message from another civilization, and immediately went into this reaction of, good heavens, interstellar travel is possible. They can communicate with us. Logic is universal. Truly a very surprising moment.
You tried to translate further messages, as you mentioned in your book, Man and the Stars. What happened there?
Well, what I thought, perhaps wrongly in retrospect, that this wouldn't be taken seriously unless I could translate most, if not all, of the 1920s records. So I spent quite a few months getting hold of all of the records I could locate and trying to make sense of them in the same way as I had with that first signal. And I came up with what appeared to be a coherent story coming out of these messages, a substantial chunk of which has since turned out, in fact, over the next couple of years, turned out to be wrong. So I ended up regarding the whole thing as suspect. And eventually I withdrew it, but it seems as if I was possibly acting a bit too soon.
Epsilon Butis, of course, is the second largest star system in the constellation Butis. They also call that star, Izar?
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's actually the fifth brightest star in the constellation, just beyond that, right? It's a double star.
It's a double star system. That's right.
Yeah, and the thing that really hit me when I looked up the characteristics of it was that the the major component of the system was an orange giant star. And immediately this plunged into another piece of the whole inquiry, a question raised by Frank Drake, the radio astronomer, mm-hmm. as to what the motivation would be for anyone to attempt interstellar travel or communication on this kind of scale. And as soon as I read that it was an orange giant, I thought, this is an appeal for help. This is like calling the fire brigade and shouting, "My house is on fire." The statement is an appeal. And then I thought, now wait a minute. These people apparently sent out these probes to open communication for them, as Bracewell had suggested. And they must have realized that there was a possibility they'd be picked up by less advanced cultures like ours. But they've thrown away any advantage that might give them in the opening message. And they're obviously hoping that they're going to reach still more advanced cultures to whom they're appealing for help, which means they have, on the one hand, they're moral beings, but on the other hand, they have the concept of help, which means that ethics as well as logic would be universal. And I was just feeling so wonderful by this time, when all of this came together. I can't help smiling even now, thinking back on it.
Have we ever aimed our, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI group? Have we aimed anything toward this star system to see if we could pick up anything?
If it's been done, I've never been told about it. I would imagine somebody has, but I don't actually know that.
Do you believe beyond any shadow of a doubt that there is an advanced civilization out in that region?
No, not anymore. Increasingly doubts came to be cast on the translation. My feeling now is that very possibly the Epsilon Botus message, the Epsilon Botus message, I think is significant, but I now think it's significant for quite different reasons. The first big problem was when we were looking at the characteristics of the star, they didn't add up. And it almost looked as if they might have been artificially modified. But it turned out that it was simply that the catalogs were wrong about the star's distance. It was actually not 103 light years away, as various catalogs said. It was 203 light years away. That meant that the characteristics of the star as we see it were fully explicable. But it also meant that part of the translation that I'd done suggesting what the characteristics of the planets were no longer made sense. And the planets that were indicated as being habitable weren't, and they never had been. At the same time, the whole thing was coming under attack from quite different directions, that people were finding increasingly obscure historical records of what happened in the 1920s. And while on the one hand it was becoming clear that the signals had actually come from a point at roughly the distance of the moon, it's called the L5 point. It's equidistant from the Earth and the moon. And it would be a logical place to put a space probe if you were trying to communicate with us. That part of it was checking out better and better. But on the other hand, the actual records from the 1920s were becoming more and more contradictory.